had. A sigh. "He was a kind man," said Oryx in a storytelling voice. Sometimes he suspected her of improvising, just to humor him. Sometimes he felt that her entire past, everything she told him, was his own invention. "He was rescuing young girls. He paid for my plane ticket, just like it said. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here. You should like him."
"Why should I like such a hypocritical, sanctimonious bastard? You didn't answer my question."
"Yes, I did, Jimmy. Now leave it alone."
"How long did he keep you locked in the garage?"
"It was more like an apartment," said Oryx. "They didn't have room in their house. I wasn't the only girl they took in."
"They?"
"Him and his wife. They were trying to be helpful."
"And she hated sex, is that it? Is that why she put up with you? You were getting the old goat off her back?" Oryx sighed.
"You always think the worst of people, Jimmy. She was a very spiritual person."
"Like fuck she was."
"Don't swear, Jimmy. I want to enjoy being with you. I don't have very much time. I have to go soon. I need to do some business." "Why do you care about things that happened so long ago?"
She leaned over him, kissed him with her nubbin-smeared mouth. "Unguent, unctuous, sumptuous, voluptuous, salacious, lubricious, delicious," went the inside of Jimmy's head. He sank down into the words, into the feelings. After a while, he said, "Where are you going?"
"Oh, someplace. I'll call you when I get there."
She never would tell him. Takeout. Now comes the part that Snowman has replayed in his head time after time. "If only" haunts him. But if only what? What could he have said or done differently? What change would have altered the course of events? In the big picture, nothing. In the small picture, so much.
"Don't go. Stay here."
At least that way they would have been together. She might even have survived. Why not? In which case, she'd be right here with him, right now.
"I just want some takeout. I'm just going to the mall. I need some air. I need a walk. Let me come with you. It's not safe."
"Don't be silly. There's guards everywhere. They all know who I am. Who's safer than me?"
"I have a gut feeling."
But Jimmy'd had no gut feeling. He'd been happy that evening, happy and lazy. She'd arrived at his door an hour earlier. She'd just come from being with the Crakers, teaching them a few more leaves and grasses, so she was damp from the shower. She was wearing some sort of kimono, covered with red and orange butterflies. Her dark hair was braided with pink ribbon, coiled up and pinned loosely. The first thing he'd done when she'd arrived at his door, hurrying, breathless, brimming with joyous excitement, or a very good imitation of it, was to unpin her hair. The braid went three times around his hand.
"Where's Crake?" he whispered.
She smelled of lemons, of crushed herbs.
"Don't worry, Jimmy."
"But where?"
"He's outside paradise. He went out. He had a meeting.
He doesn't want to see me when he comes back. He said he would be thinking tonight. He never wants sex when he's thinking." "Do you love me?" That laugh of hers. What had it meant? Stupid question. Why ask? You talk too much. Or else, what is love? Or possibly, in your dreams. Then time passed. Then she was pinning her hair up again, then slipping on her kimono, then tying it with the sash. He stood behind her, watching in the mirror. He wanted to put his arms around her, take off the covering she'd just put back on, start all over again.
"Don't go yet," he said. But it was never any use saying "don't go yet" to her.
When she'd decided a thing, she was on her way. Sometimes he felt he was merely a house call on a secret itinerary of hers, that she had a whole list of others to be dealt with before the night was over. Unworthy thoughts, but not out of the question. He never knew what she was doing when she wasn't with him.
"I'm coming back right away," she said,
slipping her feet into her little pink and red sandals.
"I'll bring pizza. You want any extras, Jimmy?"
"Why don't we dump all this crap? Go away somewhere," he said on impulse.
"Away from here? From paradise? Why?"
"We could be together."
"Jimmy, you're funny. We're together now."
We could get away from Crake, said Jimmy. We wouldn't have to sneak around like this. We could...
But Jimmy,
wide eyes,
Crake needs us.
I think he knows, said Jimmy, about us. He didn't believe this, or he believed it and not, both at the same time. Surely they'd been more and more reckless lately. How could Crake have missed it? Was it possible for a man that intelligent in so many ways to be acutely brain-damaged in others? Or did Crake have a deviousness that outdid Jimmy's own? If so, there were no signs. Jimmy had taken to sweeping his room for bugs, the hidden mini-mics, the micro-cams. He'd known what to look for, or so he thought. But there'd been nothing. There were signs, Snowman thinks. There were signs, and I missed them. For instance, Crake said once, "Would you kill someone you loved to spare them pain?" "You mean commit euthanasia?" said Jimmy. "Like putting down your pet turtle?"
"Just tell me," said Crake.
"I don't know. What kind of love? What kind of pain?" Crake changed the subject. Then, one lunchtime, he said, "If anything happens to me, I'm depending on you to look after the Paradise Project. Any time I'm away from here, I want you to take charge. I've made it a standing order."
"What do you mean, anything?" said Jimmy. "What could happen?"
"You know." Jimmy thought he meant kidnapping or being whacked by the opposition. That was a constant hazard for the compound brainiacs.
"Sure," he said. "But, one, your security's the best, and two, there's people in here much better equipped than I am. I couldn't head up a thing like this. I don't have the science."
"These people are specialists," said Crake. "They wouldn't have the empathy to deal with the Paradise models. They wouldn't be any good at it. They'd get impatient. Even I couldn't do it. I couldn't begin to get onto their wavelength. But you're more of a generalist."
"Meaning?"
"You have a great ability to sit around not doing much of anything, just like them."
"Thanks," said Jimmy.
"No, I'm serious. I'd want it to be you."
"What about Oryx?" said Jimmy. "She knows the Crakers a lot better than I do."
Jimmy and Oryx said Crakers, but Crake never did.
"If I'm not around, Oryx won't be either," said Crake.
"She'll commit suti?
No shit. Immolate herself on your funeral pyre?"
"Something like that," said Crake, grinning.
Which at the time Jimmy had taken both as a joke and also as a symptom of Crake's truly colossal ego. "I think Crake's been snooping on us," said Jimmy that last night. As soon as it was out, he saw it could be true, though maybe he was just saying it to frighten Oryx, stampede her perhaps, though he had no concrete plans. Suppose they ran, where would they live? How would they keep Crake from finding them? What would they use for money? Would Jimmy have to turn pimp, live off the avails? Because he certainly had no marketable skills, nothing he could use in the plebelands, not if they went underground, as they would have to do. "I think he's jealous."
"Oh, Jimmy, why would Crake be jealous? He doesn't approve of jealousy. He thinks it's wrong."
"He's human," said Jimmy. "What he approves of is beside the point."
"Jimmy, I think it's you that's jealous."
Oryx smiled, stood on tiptoe, kissed his nose.
"You're a good boy, but I would never leave Crake. I believe in Crake. I believe in his..."
She groped for the word.
"His... vision. He wants to make the world a better place. This is what he's always telling me. I think that is so fine, don't you, Jimmy?"
"I don't believe that," said Jimmy. "I know it's what he says, but I've never bought it. He never gave a piss about anything like that. His interests were strictly..."
"Oh, you are wrong, Jimmy. He has found the problems. I think he is right. There are too many people, and that makes the people bad. I know this from my own life, Jimmy. Crake is a very smart man."
Jimmy should have known better than to badmouth Crake. Crake was her hero in a way, an important way, as he, Jimmy, was not. "Okay, point taken." At least he hadn't completely blown it. She wasn't angry with him. That was the main thing. "What a mushball I was," thinks Snowman. "How entranced, how possessed." Not was, am.
Jimmy, I want you to promise me something.
Sure, what?
If Craig isn't here, if he goes away somewhere, and if I'm not here either, I want you to take care of the Craigers.
Not here? Why wouldn't you be here?
Anxiety again, suspicion. Were they planning to go off together, leaving him behind? Was that it? Had he only been some sort of toy boy for Oryx, a court jester for Craig?
You're going on a honeymoon or what?
Don't be silly, Jimmy. They are like children. They need someone. You have to be kind with them.
You're looking at the wrong man, said Jimmy. If I had to spend more than 5 minutes with them, they'd drive me nuts.
I know you could do it. I'm serious, Jimmy. Say you'll do it. Don't let me down. Promise?
She was stroking him, running a row of kisses up his arm. Okay, then. Cross my heart and hope to die. Happy now? It didn't cost him anything. It was all purely theoretical.
Yes, now I'm happy. I'll be very quick, Jimmy. Then we can eat. You want anchovies?
What did she have in mind, Snowman wonders, for the millionth time?
How much did she guess?
Airlock. He'd waited for her, at first with impatience, then with anxiety, then panic. It shouldn't take them that long to make a couple of pizzas. The first bulletin came in at 9:45. Because Craig was off-site and Jimmy was second in command, they sent a staff member from the video monitor room to get him. At first Jimmy thought it was routine, another minor epidemic or splotch of bioterrorism, just another news item. The boys and girls with the hot biosuits and the flamethrowers and the isolation tents and the crates of bleach and the lime pits would take care of it as usual. Anyway, it was in Brazil, far enough away. But Craig's standing order was to report any outbreaks of anything, anywhere, so Jimmy went to look. Then the next one hit, and the next, rapid fire. Taiwan, Bangkok, Saudi Arabia, Bombay, Paris, Berlin, the plebelands west of Chicago. The maps on the monitor screens lit up, spackled with red as if someone had flicked a loaded paintbrush at them. This was more than a few isolated plague spots. This was major. Jimmy tried phoning Craig on his cell, but he got no reply. He told the monitor crew to go to the news channels. It was a rogue hemorrhagic, said the commentators. The symptoms were high fever, bleeding from the eyes and skin, convulsions, then breakdown of the inner organs followed by death. The time from visible onset to final moment was amazingly short. The bug appeared to be airborne, but there might be a water factor as well. Jimmy's cell phone rang. It was Oryx.
"Where are you?" he shouted. "Get back here. Have you seen—"
Oryx was crying. This was so unusual, Jimmy was rattled by it.
"Oh, Jimmy," she said. "I am so sorry. I did not know."
"It's all right," he said to soothe her. Then, "What do you mean?"
"It was in the pills. It was in those pills I was giving away, the ones I was selling. It's all the same cities. I went there. Those pills were supposed to help people. Craig said—"
The connection was broken. He tried dial back. Ring, ring, ring. Then a click. Then nothing. What if the thing was already inside Rejuve? What if she'd been exposed? When she turned up at the door, he couldn't lock her out. He couldn't bear to do that, even if she was bleeding from every pore. By midnight, the hits were coming almost simultaneously. Dallas, Seattle, New York. The thing didn't appear to be spreading from city to city. It was breaking out in a number of them, simultaneously. There were three staff in the room now. Rhino, Beluga, White Sedge. One was humming, one whistling. The third, White Sedge, was crying. This is the biggie. Two of them had already said that.
"What's our fallback? What should we do?"
"Nothing," said Jimmy, trying not to panic. "We're safe enough here. We can wait it out. There's enough supplies in the storeroom." He looked around at the three nervous faces. "We have to protect the Paradise models. We don't know the incubation period. We don't know who could be a carrier. We can't let anybody in." This reassured them a little. He went out of the monitor room, reset the codes of the inmost door,
and also those on the door leading into the airlock. While he was doing this, his video cell beeped. It was Crake. His face on the tiny screen looked much as usual. He appeared to be in a bar.
"Where are you?" Jimmy yelled. "Don't you know what's going on?"
"Not to worry," said Crake. "Everything's under control." He sounded drunk, a rare thing for him.
"What fucking everything? It's a worldwide plague. It's the Red Death. What's this about it being in the Bliss Plus pills?"
"Who told you that?" said Crake. "A little bird?" He was drunk for sure, drunk or on some pharmaceutical.
"Never mind. It's true, isn't it?"
"I'm in the mall at the pizza place. I'll be there right away," said Crake. "Hold the fort." Crake hung up. Maybe he's found Oryx, Jimmy thought. Maybe he'll get her back safely. Then he thought, "You halfwit." He went to check up on the Paradise Project. The night sky simulation was on. The full moon was shining. The Krakers, as far as he could tell, were peacefully asleep.
"Sweet dreams," he whispered to them through the glass. "Sleep tight. You're the only ones now who can."
What happened then was a slow-motion sequence. It was porn, with the sound muted. It was brain frizz without the ads. It was melodrama so overdone that he and Crake would have laughed their heads off at it if they'd been 14 and watching it on DVD. First came the waiting. He sat in a chair in his office, told himself to calm down. The old word lists were whipping through his head. Fungible. Pullulate. Pistic. Cerements. Trull. After a while he stood up. Prattlement. Opsimath. He turned on his computer, went through the news sites. There was a lot of dismay out there, and not nearly enough ambulances. The Keep Calm Politico speeches were already underway. The Stay in Your House megaphone vehicles were prowling the streets. Prayer had broken out. Concatenation. Subfusc. Grutch. He went to the emergency storeroom, picked up a spray gun, strapped it on, put a loose tropical jacket over it. He went back to the monitor room and told the three staff that he'd talked with Corps Secours security for the compound, a lie, and they were in no immediate danger here. Also a lie, he suspected. He added that he'd heard from Crake, whose orders were that they should all go back to their rooms and get some sleep, because they would need their energy in the days to come. They seemed relieved and happy to comply. Jimmy accompanied them to the airlock and coded them into the corridor that led to their sleeping quarters. He watched their backs as they walked in front of him. He saw them as already dead. He was sorry about that, but he couldn't take chances. They were 3 to 1. If they became hysterical, if they tried to break out of the complex or let their friends into it, he wouldn't be able to control them. Once they were out of sight, he locked them out, and himself in. Nobody in the inner bubble now but himself and the Krakers. He watched the news some more, drinking scotch to fortify himself, but spacing his intake. Windlestraw. Laryngeal. Banshee. Woad. He was waiting for Oryx, but without hope. Something must have happened to her. Otherwise she'd be here. Towards dawn, the door monitor beeped. Someone was punching in the numbers for the airlock. It wouldn't work, of course, because Jimmy had changed the code. The video intercom jangled.
"What are you doing?" said Crake. He looked and sounded annoyed. "Open up."
"I'm following Plan B," said Jimmy. "In the event of a bio attack, don't let anybody in. Your orders. I've sealed the airlock."
"Anybody didn't mean me," said Crake. "Don't be a corknut."
"How do I know you're not a carrier?" said Jimmy.
"I'm not. How do I know that?" "Let's just suppose," said Crake wearily, "that I anticipated this event and took precautions. Anyway, you're immune to this."
"Why would I be?" said Jimmy. His brain was slow on logic tonight. There was something wrong with what Crake had just said, but he couldn't pinpoint it.
"The antibody serum was in the plebe vaccine. Remember all those times you shot up with that stuff? Every time you went to the plebes to wallow in the mud and drown your lovesick sorrows?"
"How did you know?" said Jimmy. "How did you know where what I wanted?" His heart was racing. He wasn't being precise. Don't be a moron. Let me in.
Jimmy coded open the door into the airlock. Now Craig was at the inmost door. Jimmy turned on the airlock video monitor. Craig's head floated, life-sized, right in front of his eyes. He looked wrecked. There was something, blood, on his shirt collar.
Where were you? Said Jimmy. Have you been in a fight?
You have no idea, said Craig.
Now let me in. Where's Oryx?
She's right here with me.
She's had a hard time.
What happened to her? What's going on out there? Let me talk to her.
She can't talk right now. I can't lift her up. I've had a few injuries. Now quit fucking the dog and let us in. Jimmy took out his spray gun. Then he punched in the code. He stood back and to the side. All the hairs on his arms were standing up. We understand more than we know. The door swung open. Craik's beige tropicals were splattered with red-brown. In his right hand was an ordinary storeroom jackknife, the kind with the two blades and the nail file and the corkscrew and the little scissors. He had his other arm around Oryx, who seemed to be asleep. Her face was against Craik's chest. Her long, pink-ribboned braid hung down her back. As Jimmy watched, frozen with disbelief, Craig let Oryx fall backwards over his left arm. He looked at Jimmy, a direct look, unsmiling.
"I'm counting on you," he said.
Then he slit her throat. Jimmy shot him. 13. Bubble. In the aftermath of the storm, the air is cooler. Mist rises from the distant trees. The sun declines. The birds are beginning their evening racket. Three crows are flying overhead, their wings black flames, their words almost audible.
Craik! Craik! They're saying.
The crickets are saying Oryx. I'm hallucinating, thinks Snowman. He progresses along the rampart, step by wrenching step. His foot feels like a gigantic, boiled wiener, stuffed with hot, masticated flesh, boneless and about to burst. Whatever bug is fermenting inside it is evidently resistant to the antibiotics in the watchtower ointment. Maybe in paradise, in the jumble of Craik's ransacked emergency storeroom, he knows how ransacked it is, he did the ransacking himself, he'll be able to find something more effective. Craik's emergency storeroom. Craik's wonderful plan. Craik's cutting-edge ideas. Craik, king of the Craikery, because Craik is still there, still in possession, still the ruler of his own domain, however dark that bubble of light has now become. Darker than dark, and some of that darkness is Snowman's. He helped with it.
Let's not go there, says Snowman.
Sweetie, you're already there. You've never left.
At the 8th watchtower, the one overlooking the park surrounding Paradise, he checks to see if either of the doors leading to the upper room are unlocked. He'd prefer to descend by a stairway if possible, but they aren't. Cautiously, he surveys the ground below through one of the observation slits. No large or medium-sized life forms visible down there. Though there's a scuttering in the underbrush, he hopes is only a squirrel. He unpacks his twisted sheet, ties it to a ventilation pipe, flimsy but the only possibility, and lowers the free end over the edge of the rampart. It's about 7 feet short, but he can stand the drop as long as he doesn't land on his bad foot. Over he goes, hand over hand down the ersatz rope. He hangs at the end of it like a spider, hesitates. Isn't there a technique for doing this? What has he read about parachutes? Something about bending your knees? Then he lets go. He lands two-footed. The pain is intense, but after rolling around on the muddy ground for a time and making speared animal noises, he hauls himself whimpering to his feet. Revision to his foot. Nothing seems to be broken. He looks around for a stick to use as a crutch, finds one. Good thing about sticks, they grow on trees. Now he's thirsty. Through the verdure and upspringing weeds he goes, hoppity-hoppity-hop, gritting his teeth. On the way he steps on a huge banana slug, almost falls. He hates that feeling. cold, viscous, like a peeled, refrigerated mussel. Creeping snot. If he were a Kraker, he'd have to apologize to it. "I'm sorry I stepped on you, child of Oryx. Please forgive my clumsiness." He tries it out. "I'm sorry." Did he hear something? An answer? When the slugs begin to talk, there's no time to lose. He reaches the bubble dome, circles around the white, hot, icy swell of it to the front. The airlock door is open as he remembers it. A deep breath, and in he goes. Here are Crake and Oryx, what's left of them. They've been vulturized. They're scattered, here and there, small and large bones mingled and in disarray, like a giant jigsaw puzzle. Here's Snowman, thick as a brick, dunderhead, frivol, and dupe. Water running down his face, giant fist clenching his heart, staring down at his one true love and his best friend in all the world. Crake's empty eye sockets look up at Snowman, as his empty eyes once before. He's grinning with all the teeth in his head. As for Oryx, she's face down. She's turned her head away from him, as if in mourning. The ribbon in her hair is as pink as ever. Oh, how to lament. He's a failure even at that. Snowman goes through the inner doorway, past the security area, into the staff living quarters. Warm air, humid, unfresh. The first place he needs is the storeroom. He finds it without difficulty. Dark except for a few skylights, but he's got his flashlight. There's a smell of mildew, and of rats or mice, but otherwise the place is untouched since he was last here. He locates the medical supply shelves, roots around, tongue depressors, gauze pads, burn dressings, a box of rectal thermometers, but he doesn't need one of them stuffed up his anus to tell him he's burning up. Three or four kinds of antibiotics, pill form, and therefore slow-acting, plus one last bottle of Crake's super germicide short-term plebland cocktail. Get you there and back, but don't stay until the clock strikes midnight, or you'll turn into a pumpkin, is what Crake used to say. He reads the label, Crake's precise notations, estimates the measurement. He's so weak now he can hardly lift the bottle. It takes him a while to get the top off. Glug, 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 says his voice balloon. Down the hatch. But no, he shouldn't drink it. He finds a box of clean syringes, shoots himself up. Bite the dust, foot germs, he says. Then he hobbles to his own suite, what used to be his own suite, and collapses onto the damp, unmade bed, and goes brown out. Alex the parrot comes to him in a dream. It flies in through the window, lands close to him on the pillow, bright green this time, with purple wings and a yellow beak, glowing like a beacon, and Snowman is suffused with happiness and love. It cocks its head, looks at him first with one eye, then the other. "The blue triangle," it says. Then it begins to flush, to turn red, beginning with the eye. This change is frightening, as if it's a parrot-shaped light bulb filling up with blood. "I'm going away now," it says. "No, wait," Snowman calls, or wants to call. His mouth won't move. "Don't go yet. Tell me..." Then there's a rush of wind. Woof. And Alex is gone. And Snowman is sitting up in his former bed, in the dark, drenched in sweat. Scribble. The next morning, his foot is somewhat better. The swelling has gone down. The pain is decreased. When evening falls, he'll give himself another shot of Crake's super drug. He knows he can't overdo it, however. The stuff is very potent. Too much of it, and his cells will pop like grapes. Daylight filters through the insulating glass bricks facing the skylight window well. He roams around the space he once inhabited, feeling like a disembodied sensor. Here is his closet. Here are the clothes once his, tropical weight shirts and shorts, ranged neatly on hangers and beginning to molder. Footwear, too, but he can no longer stand the thought of footwear. It would be like adding hooves, plus his infected foot might not fit. Underpants in stacks on the shelves. Why did he used to wear such garments? They appear to him now as some sort of weird bondage gear.
In the storeroom, he finds some packets and cans. For breakfast, he has cold ravioli and tomato sauce and half a Jolt bar, washed down with a warm Coke. No hard liquor or beer left. He'd gone through all of that during the weeks he'd been sealed in here. Just as well. His impulse would have been to drink it up as fast as possible, turn all memory to white noise. No hope of that now. He's stuck in time past. The wet sand is rising. He's sinking down. After he'd shot Craik, he recoded the inner door, sealed it shut. Craik and Oryx lay intertwined in the airlock. He couldn't bear to touch them, so he'd left them where they were. He'd had a fleeting romantic impulse. Maybe he should cut off a piece of Oryx's dark braid. But he'd resisted it. He went back to his room and drank some scotch and then some more, as much as it took to conk himself out. What woke him up was the buzzer from the outer door. White Sedge and Black Rhino, trying to get back in. The others, too, no doubt. Jimmy ignored them. Sometime the next day, he made 4 slices of soy toast, forced himself to eat them, drank a bottle of water. His entire body felt like a stubbed toe, numb, but also painful. During the day, his cell phone rang. A high-ranking corpsman, looking for Craik.
"Tell that fucker to get his big fat brain the fuck over here and help figure this thing out."
"He isn't here," said Jimmy.
"Who is this?"
"I can't tell you. Security protocol."
"Listen, whoever you are, I have an idea what sort of scam that creeps up to, and when I lay my hands on him, I'm gonna break his neck. I bet he's got the vaccine for this, and he's gonna hold us up for an arm and a leg."
"Really? Is that what you think?" said Jimmy.
"I know the bastard's there. I'm coming over and blow the door in."
"I wouldn't do that," said Jimmy. "We're seeing some very strange microbe activity here. Very unusual. The place is hotter than hell. I'm toughing it out in a biosuit, but I don't really know whether I'm contaminated or not. Something's really gone off the rails."
"Oh, shit. Here? In Rejuve? I thought we were sealed off."
"Yeah, it's a bad break," said Jimmy. "My advice is, look in Bermuda. I think he went there with a lot of cash."
"So he sold us out, the little shit. Hawked it deliberately to the competition. That would figure. That would absolutely figure. Listen, thanks for the tip."
"Good luck," said Jimmy.
"Yeah, sure. Same to you."
Nobody else buzzed the outer door. Nobody tried to break in. The Rejuve folks must have got the message. As for the staff, once they'd realized the guards were gone, they must have rushed outside and made a beeline for the outer gate, for what they'd confused with freedom. 3 times a day, Jimmy checked on the Krakers, peering in at them like a voyeur. Scrap the simile. He was a voyeur. They seemed happy enough, or at least contented. They grazed, they slept, they sat for long hours doing what appeared to be nothing. The mothers nursed their babies, the young ones played. The men peed in a circle. One of the women came into her blue phase, and the men performed their courtship dance, singing, flowers in hand, azure penises waving in time. Then there was a quintuplet fertility fest, off among the shrubbery. Maybe I could do some social interaction, thought Jimmy. Help them invent the wheel. Leave a legacy of knowledge. Pass on all my words. No, he couldn't. No hope there. Sometimes they looked uneasy. They'd gather in groups. They'd murmur. The hidden mics picked them up.
Where is Oryx? When is she coming back?
She always comes back.
She should be here, teaching us. She is always teaching us. She is teaching us now.
Is she here?
Here and not here is the same thing for Oryx. She said that.
Yes, she said it.
What does it mean?
It was like some demented theology debate in the windier corners of chat room limbo. Jimmy couldn't stand listening to it for very long. The rest of the time he himself grazed, slept, sat for long hours doing nothing. For the first 2 weeks he followed world events on the net, or else on the television news. The riots in the cities as transportation broke down and supermarkets were raided. The explosions as electrical systems failed. The fires no one came to extinguish. Crowds packed the churches, mosques, synagogues, and temples to pray and repent, then poured out of them as the worshippers woke up to their increased risk of exposure. There was an exodus to small towns and rural areas, whose inhabitants fought off the refugees as long as they could with banned firearms or clubs and pitchforks. At first, the newscasters were thoroughly into it, filming the action from traffic helicopters, exclaiming as if at a football match, "Did you see that? Unbelievable! Brad, nobody can quite believe it. What we've just seen is a crazed mob of God's gardeners liberating a Chicky Knob's production facility. Brad, this is hilarious. Those Chicky Knob things can't even walk." Laughter. "Now back to the studio." It must have been during the initial mayhem, thinks Snowman, that some genius let out the Pigoons and the Wolvogs. Oh, thanks a bundle. Street preachers took to self-flagellation and ranting about the apocalypse, though they seemed disappointed. Where were the trumpets and angels? Why hadn't the moon turned to blood? Pundits in suits appeared on the screen, medical experts, graphs showing infection rates, maps tracing the extent of the epidemic. They used dark pink for that, as for the British Empire once. Jimmy would have preferred some other color. There was no disguising the fear of the commentators. "Who's next, Brad? When are they going to have a vaccine?" "Well, Simon, they're working round the clock from what I hear, but nobody's claiming to have a handle on this thing yet. It's a biggie, Brad." "Simon, you said a mouthful, but we've licked some biggies before." Encouraging grin, thumbs-up sign, unfocused eyes, facial pallor. Documentaries were hastily thrown together with images of the virus. At least they'd isolated it. It looked like the usual melting gumdrop with spines, and commentary on its methods. "This appears to be a super-virulent splice. Whether it's a species-jumping mutation or a deliberate fabrication is anybody's guess." Sage nods all round. They'd given the virus a name to make it seem more manageable. Its name was Juve, Jet Speed Ultra Virus Extraordinary. Possibly they now knew something, such as what Craig had really been up to, hidden safely in the deepest core of the rejuvenescence compound. Sitting in judgment on the world, thought Jimmy. But why had that been his right? Conspiracy theories proliferated. It was a religious thing. It was God's gardeners. It was a plot to gain world control. Boil water and don't travel advisories were issued in the first week. Handshaking was discouraged. In the same week, there was a run on latex gloves and nose cone filters. About as effective, thought Jimmy, as oranges stuck with cloves during the Black Death. "This just in, the Juve killer virus has broken out in Fiji, spared until now. Corps Secours chief declares New York a disaster area. Major arteries sealed off. Brad, this item is moving very fast. Simon, it's unbelievable." "Change can be accommodated by any system depending on its rate," Craig used to say. "Touch your head to a wall, nothing happens. But if the same head hits the same wall at 90 miles an hour, it's red paint. We're in a speed tunnel, Jimmy. When the water's moving faster than the boat, you can't control a thing." I listened, thought Jimmy, but I didn't hear. In the second week, there was full mobilization. The hastily assembled epidemic managers called the shots, field clinics, isolation tents, whole towns, then whole cities quarantined. But these efforts soon broke down as the doctors and nurses caught the thing themselves, or panicked and fled. England closes ports and airports. All communication from India has ceased. Hospitals are off-limits until further notice. If you feel ill, drink plenty of water and call the following hotline number. Do not attempt to exit cities. It wasn't Brad talking anymore, or Simon. Brad and Simon were gone. It was other people, and then others. Jimmy called the hotline number and got a recording saying it was out of service. Then he called his father, a thing he hadn't done in years. That line was out of service, too. He searched his email, no recent messages. All he found was an old birthday card he'd failed to delete. "Happy birthday, Jimmy. May all your dreams come true. Pigs with wings." One of the privately run websites showed a map, with lit-up points on it for each place that was still communicating via satellite. Jimmy watched with fascination as the points of light blinked out. He was in shock. That must have been why he couldn't take it in. The whole thing seemed like a movie. Yet there he was, and there were Oryx and Crake, dead, in the airlock. Any time he found himself thinking it was all an illusion, a practical joke of some kind, he went and looked at them. Through the bulletproof window, of course. He knew he shouldn't open the innermost door. He lived off Crake's emergency stores, the frozen goods first. If the bubble's solar system failed, the freezers and microwaves would no longer work, so he might as well eat his way through the Chicky Knob's gourmet dinners while he had the chance. He smoked up Crake's stash of skunkweed in no time flat. He managed to miss about 3 days of horror that way. He rationed the booze at first, but soon he was getting through quite a pile of it. He needed to be fried, just to face the news. He needed to be feeling not much.
"I don't believe it. I don't believe it," he'd say.
He'd begun talking to himself out loud, a bad sign.
"It isn't happening."
How could he exist in this clean, dry, monotonous, ordinary room, gobbling caramel soy corn and zucchini cheese puffs, and addling his brain on spirituous liquors and brooding on the total fiasco that was his personal life, while the entire human race was cacking out? The worst of it was that those people out there, the fear, the suffering, the wholesale death, did not really touch him. Crake used to say that Homo sapiens sapiens was not hardwired to individuate other people in numbers above 200, the size of the primal tribe, and Jimmy would reduce that number to 2. Had Oryx loved him? Had she loved him not? Did Crake know about them? How much did he know? When did he know it? Was he spying on them all along? Did he set up the grand finale as an assisted suicide? Had he intended to have Jimmy shoot him because he knew what would happen next, and he didn't deign to stick around to watch the results of what he'd done? Or did he know he wouldn't be able to withhold the formula for the vaccine once the Corpsichore got to work on him? How long had he been planning this? Could it be that Uncle Pete and possibly even Crake's own mother had been trial runs? With so much at stake, was he afraid of failure? Of being just one more incompetent nihilist? Or was he tormented by jealousy? Was he addled by love? Was it revenge? Did he just want Jimmy to put him out of his misery? Had he been a lunatic, or an intellectually honorable man who'd thought things through to their logical conclusion? And was there any difference? And so on and so forth, spinning the emotional wheels and sucking down the hooch until he could blank himself out. Meanwhile, the end of a species was taking place before his very eyes. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. How many legs does it have? Homo sapiens sapiens, joining the polar bear, the beluga whale, the onager, the burrowing owl, the long, long list. Oh, big points, Grandmaster. Sometimes he'd turn off the sound, whisper words to himself. Succulent, morphology, purblind, cordo, frass. It had a calming effect. Site after site, channel after channel went dead. A couple of the anchors, news jocks to the end, set the cameras to film their own deaths, the screams, the dissolving skins, the ruptured eyeballs and all. How theatrical, thought Jimmy. Nothing some people won't do to get on TV. You cynical shit, he told himself. Then he started to weep. Don't be so fucking sentimental, Crake used to tell him. But why not? Why shouldn't he be sentimental? It wasn't as if there was anyone around to question his taste. Once in a while he considered killing himself. It seemed mandatory. But somehow he didn't have the required energy. Anyway, killing yourself was something you did for an audience, as on nightynight.com. Under the circumstances, the here and now, it was a gesture that lacked elegance. He could imagine Crake's amused contempt and the disappointment of Oryx. But Jimmy, why do you give up? You have a job to do. You promised, remember? Perhaps he failed to take seriously his own despair. Finally, there was nothing more to watch, except old movies on DVD. He watched Humphrey Bogart and Edward G. Robinson in Key Largo.
"He wants more, don't you, Rocco? Yeah, that's it, more. That's right, I want more. Will you ever get enough?"
Or else he watched Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, flap, 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 eek, screech. You could see the strings where the avian superstars were tied to the roof. Or he watched Night of the Living Dead, lurch, arg, gnaw, choke, gurgle. Such minor paranoias were soothing to him. Then he'd turn it off, sit in front of the empty screen. All the women he'd ever known would pass in front of his eyes in the semi-darkness. His mother, too, in her magenta dressing gown, young again. Oryx came last, carrying white flowers. She looked at him, then walked slowly out of his field of vision, into the shadows where Craik was waiting. These reveries were almost pleasurable. At least while they were going on, everyone was still alive. He knew this state of affairs couldn't continue much longer. Inside Paradise proper, the Krakers were munching up the leaves and grasses faster than they could regenerate, and one of these days the solar would fail, and the backup would fail too, and Jimmy had no idea about how to fix those things. Then the air circulation would stop, and the door lock would freeze, and both he and the Krakers would be trapped inside, and they'd all suffocate. He had to get them out while there was still time, but not too soon, or there would still be some desperate people out there, and desperate would mean dangerous. What he didn't want was a bunch of disintegrating maniacs falling on their knees, clawing at him, "Cure us! Cure us!" He might be immune from the virus, unless, of course, Craik had been lying to him, but not from the rage and despair of its carriers. Anyway, how could he have had the heart to stand there and say, "Nothing can save you"? In the half-light, in the dank, Snowman wanders from space to space. Here, for instance, is his office. His computer sits on the desk, turning a blank face to him like a discarded girlfriend encountered by chance at a party. Beside the computer are a few sheets of paper, which must have been the last he'd ever written. The last he'd ever write. He picks them up with curiosity. What is it that the Jimmy he'd once been had seen fit to communicate, or at least to record, to set down in black and white with smudges for the edification of a world that no longer existed? "To whom it may concern," Jimmy had written, in ballpoint rather than printout. His computer was fried by then, but he'd persevered, laboriously, by hand. He must still have had hope. He must still have believed that the situation could be turned around, that someone would show up here in the future, someone in authority. That his words would have a meaning then, a context. As Craik had once said, Jimmy was a romantic optimist. "I don't have much time," Jimmy had written. Not a bad beginning, thinks Snowman. "I don't have much time, but I will try to set down what I believe to be the explanation for the recent extraordinary events, catastrophe. I have gone through the computer of the man known here as Craik. He left it turned on, deliberately, I believe, and I am able to report that the Juve virus was made here in the Paradise Dome by splicers hand-selected by Craik and subsequently eliminated, and was then encysted in the Bliss Plus product. There was a time-lapse factor built in to allow for wide distribution. The first batch of virus did not become active until all selected territories had been seeded, and the outbreak thus took the form of a series of rapidly overlapping waves. For the success of the plan, time was of the essence. Social disruption was maximized, and development of a vaccine effectively prevented. Craik himself had developed a vaccine concurrently with the virus, but he had destroyed it prior to his assisted suicide, death. Although various staff members of the Bliss Plus project contributed to Juve on a piecework basis, it is my belief that none, with the exception of Craik, was cognizant of what that effect would be. As for Craik's motives, I can only speculate. Perhaps..." Here the handwriting stops. Whatever Jimmy's speculations might have been on the subject of Craik's motives, they had not been recorded. Snowman crumples the sheets up, drops them onto the floor. It's the fate of these words to be eaten by beetles. He could have mentioned the change in Craik's fridge magnets. You could tell a lot about a person from their fridge magnets. Not that he'd thought much about them at the time. Remnant. On the second Friday of March, he'd been marking off the days on a calendar, God knows why, Jimmy showed himself to the Crakers for the first time. He didn't take his clothes off. He drew the line at that. He wore a set of standard-issued rejuve khaki tropicals with mesh underarms and 1,000 pockets, and his favorite fake leather sandals. The Crakers gathered around him, gazing at him with quiet wonder. They'd never seen textiles before. The children whispered and pointed. "Who are you?" said the one Crake had christened Abraham Lincoln. A tall man, brown, thinnish. It was not said impolitely. From an ordinary man, Jimmy would have found it brusque, even aggressive, but these people didn't go in for fancy language. They hadn't been taught evasion, euphemism, lily-gilding. In speech, they were plain and blunt. "My name is Snowman," said Jimmy, who had thought this over. He no longer wanted to be Jimmy, or even Jim, and especially not Thickney. His incarnation as Thickney hadn't worked out well. He needed to forget the past. The distant past, the immediate past, the past in any form. He needed to exist only in the present, without guilt, without expectation. As the Crakers did. Perhaps a different name would do that for him. "Where have you come from, O Snowman?" "I come from the place of Oryx and Craik," he said. "Craik sent me." True in a way. "And Oryx." He keeps the sentence structure simple, the message clear. He knows how to do this from watching Oryx through the mirror wall, and from listening to her, of course. "Where has Oryx gone?" "She had some things to do," said Snowman. That was all he could come up with. Simply pronouncing her name had choked him up. "Why have Craik and Oryx sent you to us?" asked the woman called Madame Curie. "To take you to a new place." "But this is our place. We are content where we are." "Oryx and Craik wish you to have a better place than this," said Snowman, "where there will be more to eat." There were nods, smiles. Oryx and Craik wished them well, as they'd always known. It seemed to be enough for them. "Why is your skin so loose?" said one of the children. "I was made in a different way from you," Snowman said. He was beginning to find this conversation of interest, like a game. These people were like blank pages. He could write whatever he wanted on them. "Craik made me with two kinds of skin. One comes off." He took off his tropical vest to show them. They stared with interest at the hair on his chest. "What is that?" "These are feathers, little feathers. Oryx gave them to me as a special favor. See? More feathers are growing out of my face." He lets the children touch the stubble. He'd been lax about shaving lately. There seemed to be little point to it, so his beard was sprouting.
"Yes, we see. But what are feathers?"
"Oh, right. They'd never seen any." "Some of the children of Oryx have feathers on them," he said. "That kind are called birds. We'll go to where they are. Then you'll know about feathers." Snowman marveled at his own facility. He was dancing gracefully around the truth, light-footed, light-fingered. But it was almost too easy. They accepted without question everything he said. Much more of this, whole days, whole weeks of it, and he could see himself screaming with boredom. "I could leave them behind," he thought. "Just leave them. Let them fend for themselves. They aren't my business." But he couldn't do that, because although the Crakers weren't his business, they were now his responsibility. Who else did they have? Who else did he have, for that matter? Snowman planned the route in advance. Craik's storeroom was well supplied with maps. He'd take the children of Craik to the seashore, where he himself had never been. It was something to look forward to. At last he would see the ocean. He'd walk on a beach, as in stories told by the grown-ups when he was young. He might even go swimming. It wouldn't be too bad. The Crakers could live in the park near the Arboretum, colored green on the map and marked with a tree symbol, They'd feel at home there, and certainly there would be lots of edible foliage. As for himself, there would surely be fish. He gathered together some supplies, not too much, not too heavy. He'd have to carry it all, and loaded up his spray gun with the full complement of virtual bullets. The evening before the departure, he gave a talk. On the way to their new, better place, he would walk ahead, he said, with two of the men. He picked the tallest. Behind them would come the women and children, with a file of men to either side. The rest of the men would walk behind. They needed to do this because Craik had said that this was the proper way. It was best to avoid mentioning the possible dangers. Those would require too much exposition. If the Craikers noticed anything moving, anything at all, in whatever shape or form, they were to tell him at once. Some of the things they might see would be puzzling, but they were not to be alarmed. If they told him in time, these things would not be able to hurt them.
"Why would they hurt us?" asked Sojourner Truth.
"They might hurt you by mistake," said Snowman, "as the ground hurts you when you fall on it."
"But it is not the ground's wish to hurt us.
Oryx has told us that the ground is our friend. It grows our food for us." "Yes," said Snowman, "but Craik made the ground hard. Otherwise, we would not be able to walk on it." It took them a minute to work this one through. Then there was much nodding of heads. Snowman's brain was spinning. The illogic of what he'd just said dazzled him, but it seemed to have done the trick. In the dawn light, he punched in the door code for the last time and opened up the bubble and led the Craikers out of paradise. They noticed the remains of Craik lying on the ground, but as they had never seen Craik when alive, they believed Snowman when he told them this was a thing of no importance, only a sort of husk, only a sort of pod. It would have been a shock to them to have witnessed their creator in his present state. As for Oryx, she was face down and wrapped in silk. No one they'd recognize. The trees surrounding the dome were lush and green. Everything seemed pristine, but when they reached the rejuvenescence compound proper, the evidence of destruction and death lay all around. Overturned golf carts, sodden, illegible printouts, computers with their guts ripped out, rubble, fluttering cloth, gnawed carrion, broken toys. The vultures were still at their business.
"Please, O Snowman, what is that?"
"It's a dead body. What do you think?"
"It's part of the chaos," said Snowman. "Craik and Oryx are clearing away the chaos for you because they love you, but they haven't quite finished yet."
This answer seemed to content them.
"The chaos smells very bad," said one of the older children.
"Yes," said Snowman, with something he meant for a smile. "Chaos always smells bad." 5 blocks from the main compound gate, a man staggered out of a side street towards them. He was in the penultimate stages of the disease. The sweat of blood was on his forehead.
"Take me with you,"
he shouted. The words were hardly audible. The sound was animal, an animal enraged. "Stay where you are," Snowman yelled. The Craikers stood amazed, staring, but, it appeared, not frightened. The man came on, stumbled, fell. Snowman shot him. He was worried about contagion. Could the Craikers get this thing, or was their genetic material too different? Surely Craik would have given them immunity, wouldn't he? When they reached the peripheral wall, there was another one, a woman. She lurched abruptly out of the gatehouse, weeping, and grabbed at a child.
"Help me," she implored. "Don't leave me here."
Snowman shot her, too. During both incidents, the Craikers looked on in wonder. They didn't connect the noise made by Snowman's little stick with the crumpling of these people.
"What is the thing that fell down, O Snowman? Is it a man or a woman? It has extra skins like you."
"It's nothing. It's a piece of a bad dream that Craik is dreaming." They understood about dreaming, he knew that. They dreamed themselves. Craik hadn't been able to eliminate dreams. "We're hardwired for dreams," he'd said. He couldn't get rid of the singing either. "We're hardwired for singing." Singing and dreams were entwined.
"Why does Craik dream a bad dream like that?"
"He dreams it," said Snowman, "so you won't have to."
"It is sad that he suffers on our behalf."
We are very sorry. We thank him. Will the bad dream be over soon?
Yes, said Snowman. Very soon.
The last one had been a